Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we're spending time with Brian Yormug, who is a partner with Story Ventures, a seed stage fund based out of New York City. Brian, thanks for joining us today. I wanted to start things off with you telling us a little bit about your fund. How did you start this venture fund? Why and what is the thesis behind it?
Thanks for having me. So I'm one of the founding partners of Story Ventures. We started the firm about 6 years ago now. I'll give you some brief context on the founding partners because it bleeds into the thesis. So started the firm with my partner, Jake. Some folks know, some folks don't, but Jake's also my brother. So plenty of history there. Jake's background, he started out as a lawyer. So started his career out at Cravath doing large corporate law, moved over to Gunderson to get closer to the tech and venture ecosystem. While he was doing that, I started out in investment banking, then moved out to Detroit to join a venture capital firm called Fontinalis, started by Bill Ford, who's exec chairman of Ford Motor. So I was focused on the broader world of smart transportation. So autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, robotics. While I was there, Jake and I decided that we wanted to start a business. Candidly, we were between a product-oriented business and a fund. But given Jake's network in New York and my emerging thesis, which I'll touch on in a sec, we decided that a fund would be the best path forward. And I think there's a lot to explore there. In terms of the thesis, I spent a lot of time focused on autonomous vehicles in particular. And to me, there were three core technological thematics emerging in that category. One was around improvements in data capture systems. So you had improvements in camera, radar, LiDAR, but all these sensors getting way better in quality and way lower in cost. Two was improvements in compute. So movement from on-prem compute to cloud compute, movement of microprocessors to the edge. And then three was improvements at the AI or the algorithmic layer. So ability to derive insights from that data. And so if you look at the modern AV stack, that's the composition. But what we thought was that that modern data stack would impact every sector in some capacity. So the way we describe it now is that we're looking for the why now within each sector as it pertains to data. And for the most part, there's almost always a data bottleneck. So it could be that data hasn't been captured yet. It could be that it hasn't been organized, or it could be that we're at the modern application stage, but it's all around that data stack. And obviously you can walk through examples within that if it would be helpful.
So I'm to understand then that you're not just focusing on autonomous vehicles, but using that as a starting point, then you're looking at all kinds of disruptive opportunities where data as a layer plays an important role. Is that right?
Completely. So I'll give you a few examples just because I know it's a bit esoteric. And I think examples have a little bite to it. If you take the appraisal space, for example, we invested in a company called True Footage. So in the newest smartphones, you have now a LiDAR sensor. What that means is that you can create a 3D map of your environment. You have LiDAR plus camera, so you can take your phone, turn it all the way around, and you can actually create a 3D rendering of the world around you. So what True Footage does is they automate the home appraisal process. Instead of having to send an appraiser on site, you can have a homeowner, a gig economy worker, a broker take that video. They extract the data from it and they send it to the appraisers. The insight there is that the change was around data capture, which is that this was not possible until a LiDAR sensor was small enough and ubiquitous enough that anybody could do this. So now that it's in the smartphone, you have the sensor out in the world that can do the work of data capture, and it enables a whole new business. If you take healthcare, for example, a lot of folks will know EHRs, which are electronic health records. Historically, those have been siloed systems. But in 2020, the government came down with a mandate, a regulation that forced companies like Epic, Cerner, Allscripts to open up their databases. And so you have all these demand side partners, telehealth companies alike, that want to get access to that data, but there's actually no intermediary. So we invested in a company called Particle Health, which provides access to that data. So they plug into all the EHRs, they aggregate, normalize that data, and they provide it to the telehealth companies of the world. But the insight there is that the data existed, it just hadn't yet been accessible. And then the last progression of that is in our newest fund, we invested in a company called Lives, L-I-V-E-Z. So they're a proactive, predictive healthcare platform that sells to employers. The idea is for employers that most of the cost comes from chronic disease comorbidities. So what you really want to do is mitigate the origination of those disease states. So there are guidelines, CDC guidelines, international guidelines that suggest what you should do proactively to avoid illness and disease. But historically, it would have been very hard to get data on an individual to know what to prescribe for that person. because a company like Particle Health exists, Lives can now pull EHR data plus demographic data to create a custom plan for what you should do proactively. And so the idea is basically every application of the future will be built on top of this modern data stack, which is real-time dynamic data. But we're still in the infrastructure phase of developing the sensors and the organization systems for modern applications like Lives.
Got it. And with your strategy, what's your investment criteria and what gets you really excited about a company?
We definitely take the market approach of there has to be a why now around data. And specifically what that means is what is the impact of the shift in the data landscape? If you take another example, just because I think it's helpful, we invest in a company called Food, PHOOD. They create a computer vision enabled scale to measure waste within grocery and retail. So we had obviously had an opinion around computer vision and the implications of computer vision, but what we were looking for was a commercial use case of that technology. When we looked into grocery and retail, what we found out is that the second largest cost function for grocery retailers is food waste, right? So largest is labor, second is food waste. It makes up about 20 to 30% of their cost, depending on the grocer. And what we saw was, oh, there's a very clear automatable process here that previously had to be done manually, but now can leverage computer vision. So if you can do that, if you can automate that flow, the buyers, the grocers are clearly motivated to do so. So we look basically at the impact to the end buyer. And after we get buy-in on the impact of the technology to the end buyer, then it's all about team. The way we describe the team composition is we're usually looking for a technologist paired with a commercial brain. That's somebody that understands how to leverage whatever modern technology, sensor fusion, whatever it might be, combined with somebody that has industry know-how, that has sold into the category or has relationships in some capacity. Because we deal a lot with legacy industry, we've seen that it's incredibly important to have an inroad into the industry and or institutional knowledge of the category, which definitely skews us towards slightly older founders. Probably average range is like mid to late 30s. So I don't know where that stacks, but but I would say we had in fund one invested in a handful of younger founders, all really talented folks. But the learning was definitely that you don't know what you don't know. And especially for old industry, it's really difficult to break in. So having that knowledge is really meaningful to go from seed to A in any type of timely manner.
So do you usually get involved at the seed stage then?
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. We get involved at pre-seed and seed stage. So we generally lead or co-lead. For our newest fund, we target 10%+ ownership. Another interesting quirk to our fund is we're a highly concentrated fund. So fund two was only 12 companies. Fund three will probably also only be 12 companies. The idea is we really like getting involved with the companies. Goes back to the idea of us starting a product-oriented company versus a fund. Our favorite part is getting involved with the companies. But because we're only two partners, we can only spread ourselves so thin. The idea is we're highly involved from moment of investment to Series A. We go deep into go-to-market, team composition, resources across the board, with the idea that we can probably do handoffs at the Series A once you're positioned for scale. And we think that 12 companies allows us to do that without being overstretched.
So it started out in a very specific area, but now it actually sounds very broad. And it's almost like you're, instead of focusing on a specific vertical, it almost sounds like a horizontal strategy where you find the data layer that is important in so many industries, right? And find companies that can disrupt that industry. What is your perspective on industry disruption? Is it happening all over the place? And how do you go about finding the areas? Are you prescriptive where you say, hey, I'm willing to bet that insurance is going to be one? Or do you get the signals from the founders who come to you and say, hey, I got a great idea?
Yeah, it's a great question. We definitely act under the assumption that the world is moving towards a data-driven, open data ecosystem, right? And in that assumption, we think that every industry is going to move in that direction at some point. What we really focus on is the why now in particular. What that really results in is a deep dive into what are the headwinds or tailwinds for an industry. If you take healthcare in 2020, it was the federal regulation that was pushing EHRs to open up their databases. And there was now an absolute motivation for the EHRs to open up, plus a whole new ecosystem of businesses that could be created off of that. So regulation is a big one. And then competition is a massive one. You think about the Amazon effect that everybody talks about, but the way that played out in supply chain, for example, was that 3PLs were forced to innovate. So you were looking at slow robotics adoption for an extended period of time, and then Amazon continued to innovate on that front. And 3PLs continued to fall behind to the point where they were forced to say, hey, we have to invest in technology to level up our automation to be at least somewhat comparable. And so we saw probably 2 to 4 years ago that shift, which was, okay, we cannot survive unless we change. And I would say the biggest learning to me over the past 5 years has been don't invest in anything where people say they want it, but invest in things where it feels existential, where if they do not do it, they will die. The last part, because we're spending more time here, is that we're actually spending a lot more time in tech-enabled services. So for legacy industry, for example, there is a concept that you can sell into manufacturers, and there are companies that have done well doing that. What we've actually been focused on are finding folks that are just becoming the modern manufacturers. So saying, hey, we can build the entire technical stack to automate X percent of labor. And so we can be the best manufacturer because we can deliver a product faster, cheaper, better, whatever it might be. An example of that is we invested in a company called ViaPhoton, V-I-A-P-H-O-T-O-N, and they manufacture and assemble fiber optic cable. The idea is when you stand up a data center or a 5G tower, you have to actually connect cabling. To do that, the CEO was at a large company within the space and basically realized that the two problems were speed of delivery and quality control because most of the vendors were international. So he said, I'm going to stand up a local assembly and manufacturing facility in the US to sell to the hyperscalers of the world. The critical insight was that he thought he could automate about 20 to 30% of the labor, which is that because US labor was more expensive, unless you could get to cost parity, it would be difficult. But he was able to stand up a manufacturing line where he was able to decrease the labor component and still, so cost parity, but then faster delivery, higher quality. And they've scaled incredibly quickly because there's very little innovation in the industry. And because of their insights, they've been able to be competitive. And so the growth there has definitely informed our opinion around if there's old industry you can just take on altogether. It's a really large lift, but there's a ton of opportunity on the other side of it.
Do you have any themes or predictions for 2022?
I'm just starting.
<That's> fair.
Themes, predictions for 2022. I would say the categories I like, I still think that LiDAR and smartphones is an underutilized technology.
For the audience, which phones have LiDAR right now?
The iPhone 13 has a LiDAR sensor. I think the newest Google Pixel coming out will have a LiDAR sensor, and every future iteration will have it. So we're definitely very early in the progression. But the reality is you can even subsidize these things because it has a commercial use case. If you are a broker or if you're a brokerage house, you can easily actually just give out these phones because they cost benefit to decreasing having to send an appraisal on site. There's a lot of things you can do from a cost perspective, but it's still very nascent. And then I would say another trend, and maybe this just gets into, because I've been spending a lot of time with this company, and Thanasis, I told you about this one, but in 2016, I invested in a company called Motorq. It's a connected vehicle API. The idea is that they're able to pull data directly from the vehicle. So if you think about Avis or Hertz, and you think about them wanting to track their vehicles, historically, the way to do that is there's something called an OBD port in vehicles, which is an onboard diagnostics port. Something you plug basically a USB key into to track the vehicle, whatever you want. But there's friction there, right? You have to plug in hardware, you have to buy hardware, you need compliance that the hardware is actually plugged in. So the idea is now with cars being built internet connectivity, you can have a software API that pulls the data directly from the vehicle. And so we invested in Motorq in 2016. It has taken about 4 years to build out the relationships with the OEM, so the manufacturers, so that Motorq can actually get access to that data. And then similarly, 4 years to build out commercial contracts with the largest fleets in the world, because you have to shift their entire data infrastructure, right? So that they can pull that data, parse it through into their UI, whatever it might be. But it does feel like now about 95% of cars coming offline have internet connectivity. And it does feel like we're at an inflection point where we're going to see a lot of use cases around connected vehicle data. Whereas it went slower than I was maybe thinking, it does actually feel like over the next 1 to 3 years, I actually think there will start to be consumer implications for connected vehicle data. I mean, even thinking about the future of package delivery and permissioning and all that, it feels like we're actually getting close to that, which I think will be a really cool trend to watch and probably somewhat under the radar.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What is it like to start a venture fund with your brother? I could see being very positive, but it could also be drive you crazy depending on your relationship.
Completely. I would say, usually say to most people, if you have siblings, you know that you can or cannot. And it's usually not in between. It's like, oh, I definitely could work with this person, or I definitely cannot work with this person. I think the nice thing for Jake and I is that we are very goal-oriented people, and we have the same ambition and the same goal in terms of what we want to build and how we want to build it. So on the macro, I think we agree basically on 98% to 99% of what we do. It doesn't mean that we don't just start yelling at each other often just because we're brothers. So there's definitely the family dynamic, and we've been told not to come to holidays if we're going to talk about work. So there's all of those quirks. But at the end of the day, I would say it's rare you get to work with somebody that you know so well and that can move the needle in a way, because there's so much inherent trust from just growing up together. I'm hard pressed to think that there could be a better partner given the history. And so I think we're incredibly fortunate.
What is your best or funniest childhood memory with your brother?
I don't even have childhood memories anymore. It's been a whole reset. It's
been a minute.
I would say...
You can just say past too.
No. So Jake is the oldest. I'm one of four boys. So Jake's the oldest brother. Aaron is between myself and Jake. And then Willie's the youngest brother. And I always remember the games that Jake would organize when we were younger, and it would always be 2v2, right? Because there's four of us. And so football, basketball, baseball, whatever it was, soccer. And I think it's interesting to see that, to me, and it gets to maybe a future question, but to me, the thing I focus on is like, how do people's brains work? And it's so interesting that I can remember how Jake's brain worked when we were 5, 10, 15 years old, and it's the same as it is now. It's obviously shifted in terms of who he is in the world, but how he operated, how he organized his community, how he thought about games, puzzles is all the exact same. And so seeing that translation into adult form, I just find to be fascinating.
You guys should bring in the other two, and you guys could be like the Gronk brothers in BC.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if the other two would love that.
They don't. They might not have a choice.
Right. That's fair. Well, the one between Jake and I, he's a woodworker, and it's a completely different type of brain as well. And again, these are all interesting things because it's just, we all came from the same family, but we're all actually very different people.
Right.
So it's been interesting as we've gotten older.
It sounds like it. I mean, tell us, how did you get into technology? Were you interested in technology as a child, or how did you get engaged in that?
So I went to Penn undergrad. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I always knew I would describe it as numbers. And that felt like I should do investment banking then, because numbers, investment banking, without really knowing too much about investment banking. As soon as I started doing investment banking, I think I had two insights. One is that I really don't enjoy corporate culture, which is just that it felt slow, unmotivational, bureaucratic, and it was everything that I wasn't. And I always told my parents when I was younger that I wanted to start a business, but I didn't really know why. And I think I realized it when I started doing banking, which is that there was an inefficiency that doesn't sit well with me. So there was that component. And then as I was just sitting at my desk for 14 hours, 16 hours doing banking, I would just start reading. And for whatever reason, I always gravitated towards technology. And I think it's because of the creative aspect of it. You don't really know what's going to exist, but there is a logic puzzle in there, which is, can you predict what might come about in the future with uncertain and complex information? And then actually the big shift for me was after doing a year of banking, I ended up finding out about a fellowship program called Venture for America. For folks not familiar, it's similar to Teach for America, which most people know, but it's for entrepreneurship. So basically getting placed into emerging cities across the US, Detroit, Cleveland, Baltimore, to help with the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And so through that, there's then a matching portal where you apply for jobs. And the one job that stood out to me was the job at Fontanalis, which was basically to be an analyst associate for looking at autonomous vehicles. And I remember at the time I applied for the job and I had no idea, like absolutely no idea about anything technology related. So they asked me, what company would you invest in? And I was like, Uber, which was already a multi-billion dollar company at the time. But I think I got a really fortunate break, which was that they were looking for somebody with a finance background, which I had, and I was able to jump in. And ever since then, I've just loved the puzzles of technology, which is just decomposing the problem sets and figuring out what we think the future will look like.
So on the car front, speaking of autonomous vehicles, there's been a hot debate in our firm. And we looked at a few companies in that space, and it's always, okay, when is it going to happen, right? It's almost there, but still there's a lot of hurdles. And is this a 3-year thing, 5-year thing, 10-year thing, when you really have truly autonomous L4 stage vehicles driving themselves? Since you were so close to that, what's your perspective on that?
I would say there's two things. One is that I personally still believe people are overestimating the business case of investing in autonomy, which is to say that to me, I view it as an enabling technology, right? And for the most part, enabling technologies to me enable the best businesses. They are not the best businesses. So I think we'll see autonomy, and I'll touch on that in a second, but I still think people are overestimating the value accrued to the companies that develop the autonomous system. So that's one note, because I don't think most people agree with me on that. In terms of actual autonomy, what I would say is that to me, the largest problem is the compute issue, which is that you need to process a ton of data on the edge, and we don't have near the infrastructure to be able to do that. Even outside of the computer vision, LiDAR, radar components, which I think we're actually closer on, I think it's going to be sheer compute that's probably going to end up being the largest problem, and building that into the supply chain for the autos. The way I've described it is basically, the less complex the problem, the more automatable it is. So I think you'll start to see autonomy in trucking yards and in controlled environments, whatever it might be, because you can use less compute, you can do pre-mapping, things like that. But for more complex problems, I still think we're 5+ years out in terms of true scaled autonomy. But I do think we'll start to see it. There are already companies that are operating some level of or a level 4 autonomous environment, just in a far smaller fashion.
Where does the name Story Ventures come from?
Out of thin air, but there are a bunch of iterations of this story. So I honestly don't even remember what the true story is anymore, but I'll give you the one that's top of mind. So we were just
make one up.
Right, exactly. We were throwing out names in the same fashion. You just throw out concepts, things that are interesting. And so the first place we started, just because this is somewhat funny. So Jake and I actually started working together. I don't know if you all know the company FanDuel, but it's a daily fantasy site. And so Jake and I started doing that first year that FanDuel came about, and we started building basic models, assumptions. We're big football fans, and we started doing really well. So we actually raised a mini fund from our friends to deploy into FanDuel. So we raised like $20,000, and every week we would spend hours just putting together teams, and we would send out a community update to our investors to let them know what their teams were for the weekend. And it was actually how we started to work together. Then we started Story, and we completely cut out that business. But the first name we came to was YAC Ventures, because YAC in football stands for yards after catch, which is kind of like this value add component. But then we realized—
Definitely didn't know that.
Not a good acronym.
Yak Ventures.
Yak Ventures.
So we don't do that. But if you see any SPVs on cap tables that are Yak Ventures, it's because we still use it. We just don't publicize it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So we were thinking about it. And I think everything about our ethos is we're family, and we've grown up with a certain attitude that we expect of ourselves, that we look to from the world. And I think the takeaway was generally that we want to enable entrepreneurs to build their story. And we've built our own organization around who we think we are and something that is true to our ethos. And we always wanted to find people that could do the same, which is, how do you navigate that story? How do you tell it to the world? And how do you make it authentic? And we've always thought we could be helpful in terms of crafting that narrative. And so all those things came together: family, the narrative component of building a business. And then I think one of us just threw out the word story. I was like, oh, that also sounds good. So might as well run with it.
Great story behind the story. Is it just you and your brother, or are there other people on the team?
Right now it's myself, my brother, and then we have a head of operations, Carly, who's awesome. She's been with us for 2+ years now. We just finished the fundraise for our third fund. So we're now making 2 hires. We're hiring an investment associate on the team who will hopefully take off all these screener calls that I do, and we'll teach them a lot along the way. And then we're going to hire a GC COO type. I think what's interesting is Jake is an ex-lawyer. I'm an ex-investment banker. And so we see a lot of opportunity around structuring deals, creative structures, development of companies, how to think about equity, debt compositions, all that. So we're looking for somebody that has a hybrid legal financial background to think through creative business development. And to the earlier point of building a company, we definitely err towards looking at Story as a product company, right? Which is, how do we continue to iterate on what we can offer to the companies we invest in, what we can offer to our LPs. So we're definitely looking to level up what Story looks like outside of our core competency as we continue to develop that. And so bringing on those 2 roles.
Awesome.
You guys are based in New York, right?
Yeah, we're based in Manhattan.
So it's interesting because you're in a very cosmopolitan city, but you also worked in Detroit. What's your perspective about growth of venture capital into the tertiary cities? And do you look broadly, or do you focus on specific geographies?
It's a really good question. I was considering staying in Detroit even when we started the firm. And I think candidly, the ecosystem wasn't mature enough, at least at the time, for me to justify doing so. We started about 6 years ago, and I would say that my perspective was that the only mature ecosystem at the time was the Bay Area and the West Coast. Even New York at the time, I think, was very underdeveloped. We know all the firms that started 5 to 10 years ago, and there's still only a handful in New York. What I would say is the reality is for seed stage in particular, or let's say pre-A, it still feels like a local game where it's really about finding the people as they're emerging. And I think one of the complexities with secondary, tertiary cities is that there's just not that much local talent. So to me, the biggest thing for Michigan, which I push to my friends that are still there, is invest in the schooling system. All the talent that did come out of there was from University of Michigan for the most part. I mean, like Wayne State, there are a few others, but to me, you need an organic pipeline, and then you need people to stay there for some reason. I still think it's going to be difficult for those cities to develop self-sustaining ecosystems. But with that said, we've obviously seen the growth of New York, Miami, even Pittsburgh. There's a handful of cities that are scaling really nicely. So it might just be a function of time, but it still feels early in the evolution outside of the major metropolises in my mind.
What advice do you have for founders right now?
Yeah, I think this is helpful advice, and hopefully founders take it at face value that this isn't for my own interest. I would say it feels like we just entered into a capital cycle where there's a massive abundance of capital and a very real exuberance around the upside of these business ventures. And by that, I mean, we've seen massive growth in public market valuations, which are now coming down. But because of the public market growth 2 years ago, 1 year ago, there's been a trickle effect all the way into the seed stage, or up all the way into the seed stage, where I think we're seeing inflated valuations and a pretty real disconnect from where the businesses are. And I think at the end of the day, if I'm a business builder, I'm focused on 5 to 10 year time horizons. And I actually think you're doing yourself a disservice by taking massive premiums today with the expectation of what the business will be in the future. Now, that's a very blanket statement, but I guess what I would say is try to be very realistic about what it is that you're building and try to correlate valuations and capital raising to realistic expectations, because we are in an exuberant environment where I think if you are just a really good seller, you can raise well ahead. And if you don't really think through the complexities of building that business, there's a chance that there's a negative impact in a few years.
Yeah, that's great advice.
So Brian, what is your perspective on all these mega rounds that companies are raising once they hit traction? And how do you see your involvement playing over time? And I don't know if your companies are mature enough to have raised big rounds like that, but how do you foresee staying involved? You obviously know these founders really well when they get started, but as they grow, a lot of smaller funds have a tough time staying relevant on the boardroom or in the cap table.
We're definitely seeing it play out now. I would say in terms of our involvement, we view it the same way, which is just drive as much value as possible and do what's in the best interest of the company. So for the most part, post seed, we will offer to give up our board seat and make clear that we would love to stay on the board for the companies that we find relevant, but we're happy to give it up. At the end of the day, I do believe when people say this is a services business, it is a services business. And so I think we try to add as much value as possible. And that's generally shown up in that I think we've almost always gotten our pro rata plus and almost always been in the room longer than we expected. But we'll do what's in the best interest of the company, knowing that we're going to try to do what's in the best interest of our firm, which is adding value. In terms of the growth rounds, there's two dynamics. One is just there's a lot of late stage capital, which is compressing pro rata for early stage funds. So that's just an interesting dynamic. I assume you were alluding more to the opinion on the size of those rounds and the valuations. What I would say is we always anchor back to the same thing, which is the TAM and the business model. When we think about these companies, we recognize that for the most part, we're trading ahead, even at the seed stage valuation, definitely at the Series A, the Series B. So to me, it's more when you look at the applied valuation, what do you think a realistic multiple is based off of the size of the opportunity? And again, the underlying business. Motorq is a good example. I won't get into their revenue, but they're definitely trading ahead from a revenue perspective. But I am 98 to 99% certain that there are X hundred million dollars of revenue that have yet to be tapped for connected vehicle data. And you're talking about an 80 to 90% gross margin business. So if you look at comps, even from 3+ years ago, let's say prior to COVID, you can very easily underwrite to an X billion dollar outcome if they're the winner. Whereas there are a bunch of businesses, I think fintech was an interesting example in particular, where the business models are not as good. You're talking about a real need to leverage debt for a bunch of these businesses, super low margin and high commodity products over time. And so whereas I think people thought the business cases were a lot larger, you could look at the incumbents, the E-Trades of the world and say, oh, they're actually not trading at software multiples for a reason. It goes back to that same thing, which is some of these rounds I think will pay off, but I think will be dictated by the long-term business model and upside. And for whatever reason, that world has been conflated where I don't think there's as much focus on the long-term.
So now we're going to shift over to our four standard question segment. Number one is our National Venture Capital Association question. The National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there was one thing that you would change about the VC industry or one policy that you'd advocate for, what would it be?
I can't remember what the name of the show was, but it's where like the CEO goes and works on the manufacturing line of its own company. And I always think you should eat your own dog food to an extent. So to me, I think what would just be an interesting concept is as a venture investor saying, hey, I have to spend a week, a month, a year working at a portfolio company within whatever segment I focus stage. I think it actually really applies to later stage investors. So I come from New York, Northeast, Penn background. So I know a lot of private equity folks and they're great, awesome people, but they function almost entirely in numbers. They are so removed from how the business operates that there's some level of disconnect in my mind. And so I think the venture community or the investment community would only benefit by spending more time on the operational side and honestly, vice versa. But since we're talking about venture investors, I would say get some applied work experience and almost make it a mandate for your firm.
That's a really cool idea. Number two is if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I would say it would be therapist slash life coach. Life coach feels a little cliche, but I do think it's valuable. To me, the reason I like venture so much is that at the end of the day, I think it's a lot of just understanding how people's brains work. There's the objective commercial side, which is how do dollars flow? What does that look like? And then there are the people building them. And I think the best investors are good at understanding business logic and then really good at understanding how people's brains work, why they make the decisions they do. So when I spend time with entrepreneurs, I almost always gravitate towards that. And at the end of the day, these are all people, right? I find most joy in just helping the people to be the best version of themselves. I think one of the nice things is there's a natural selection to entrepreneurs, which is a lot of their motivation and ambition comes from building that business. So there's a lot of alignment with the venture community. But there are instances where I've seen entrepreneurs where I would almost guide them away from building a venture-backed business because they're looking for balance in their life or whatever it might be. So I think it's being able to apply that lens that I've always loved. And I honestly think at some point, I probably will get into that world in some capacity, hopefully after we've returned a few multiples.
That's awesome. What's your Myers-Briggs?
Honestly, I don't know, which is really
don't know. All right. Well, you have to find out and come back.
Should we guess? Exactly. Should we guess?
Yeah, we can guess. You guys can guess.
I would say
E-N. Yeah. Maybe P.
Next would be T or F. So thinking versus feeling.
Feeling. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. F.
And I don't know. So a lot of people who are very numbers oriented tend to be stronger T's. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if you're a T or an F, but I will say the next one is J or P. And P's are as many opportunities as possible, like to live in shades of gray, don't want to have to make a clear, decisive decision very quickly. J's are people who are very quick at making a decision. And actually the fun fact, easiest way to tell a J versus a P is if you're at a restaurant, and you see the menu, a P will look at the menu for a long time. They'll take into account pictures and the name of the restaurant and like, ooh, maybe I want a salad, but ooh, the chicken sounds awesome. Or maybe I also want a soup. And they take forever to basically make a decision. I am a very strong P, as Vanessa I think probably knows. So I do that in restaurants all the time. A J is very decisive. And it's like, I'm in the mood for steak. And sits down, might look at the menu, might not, and say, I want a steak.
So I just, I was looking at-
Just take the test.
No, that would have been really impressive. But I did know I took it, so I just looked at my email while we were talking. But I guess I'm an INFP.
Yeah.
And most of my scores were like middling because I think I've actually always bordered this test, which is why I never know what I am because depending on the stage of life I've been in, I know I've been an E at some point. I know I've been a J at some point. So all these have flipped, but I guess right now I'm an INFP.
I'm an INTP.
There you go.
Thanasis, what are you?
ENT borderline.
Okay. Well, now we know.
Now we know.
Awesome. All right. Number three is, who is someone that you look up to and why?
I would say, I don't want to use a cliche answer. I don't really think I look up to people. I think I respect people for a bunch of different reasons. So an example, and this is definitely cliche, but I'm recently engaged and my fiance Carly is one of the most sure people I've ever met, which is that she was either born a certain way or just progressed through life in a very particular way, where just everything she does and that however she operates is with a very real level of confidence. And I think we started this firm when I was 24. And so I had to question myself a lot. And I think I got into a mode of just questioning myself a lot for a bunch of different things. And when I talk to her, it's always a reassuring thing. I mean, something I always respect about a person, which is kind of the sureness with which you operate in the world. And so it's definitely a trait that I've picked up on. And now I see it across people, which I always find to be super interesting, but it's one that's top of mind for me.
Well, congratulations. And I'm sure that she'll be very excited to hear that answer. That's really sweet. Number four is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
So I shouldn't have answered the last question, but I did, because it's definitely in line with that. I think the best piece of advice I ever got is something to the tune of, you really need to understand who you are to understand how you want to operate in this world, especially millennial generation, Gen Z generation. I think there's a ton of anxiety, a ton of depression. And I think it goes back to the same thing, which is over optionality and lack of conviction of who you are. And I don't think that's the fault of anybody. I think it's actually just an unlearned skill. And so I think that was helpful for me when I was younger, which is look at the world, look at yourself and decide, is this what I want to do? But really build an opinion around that and then reinforce that in your own life. And that's always been a very helpful guiding principle for me, which is really try to understand yourself so that you can apply your best in the world.
Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your time and learning about you and your fund. Thank you.
Thanks. This was awesome.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc.